Thank you, Your Honor. Craig Weinberg, registration number 19030, appearing on behalf of the plaintiff appellant, 17 West Mill Street, LLC. Your Honors, I received a copy of this court's order on the specific issue that the court wanted me to focus on, so I will start with that issue. If there is additional time, I might go off on some of the other issues that have been briefed. And I'll just come right down to it and tell you what I think a fraudulent request is within the meaning of the statute. And then I'll tell you how I got there. A fraudulent request is one which is either A, the beneficiary has not requested, made, or authorized, B, one where the original note is not produced, or C, one which contains materially false statements, such as, in this case, that the note had been paid or the purpose of the deed of trust had been satisfied. And I think as a matter of interpretation, the court would either need to interpret the phrase fraudulent request to include an unauthorized request, or it would have to consider that there are other means in which a request for a release of deed of trust can be invalid under either other subsections of the statute, the common law, or otherwise, because the statute doesn't say it's the exclusive means in which a deed of trust can be voided. The defendants argued that the plaintiffs had to prove fraud in the or forgery in the common law sense, and I think that's a narrow reading of the statutory scheme in the case upon which it was based, the Upson case. In Upson, the Supreme Court indicated that there were two requirements that were necessary to have a valid release of a deed of trust. The first was that the beneficiary, in that case that was Upson, it must be the beneficiary that requests the release, and the second requirement was that the original note had to be produced. When the public trustee released the Upson deed of trust without the original, and importantly, without a request from Upson, the Supreme Court said that the public trustee exceeded her statutory authority. The court then described how, in that case, a forged deed only passed void title. But if you read the rest of the language in the opinion, it goes on to suggest that a void title was passed because the grantor never really signed the deed. And you have the same situation in this case. Let me turn to some of the language from the Supreme Court opinion. They held, in citing other cases, that the deeds are held invalid when obtained through forgery because the grantor cannot be said to have executed the instrument. A forged request for release is void, and there can be no release without a valid request. Now, to the extent that the Upson opinion was premised on a forgery, which I don't think it is, I think it's premised on the fact that the request was not made by a beneficiary of the deed of trust, and that there was no authorization for the signature. But to the extent the court wants to take that reading of the case, it would then be faced with the question of, well, what does an unauthorized deed convey? What kind of title does somebody who gets a deed that is simply unauthorized, whether it was forged or not? And that really, that's the facts in this case, but that was also decided in a case that I cited in the briefs called Newman versus Tibbetts. It was a 1915 case, but it's the only case that I can find in Colorado that addresses this subject. It is still good law. In fact, it was a Court of Appeals decision, but it was affirmed without discussion by the Supreme Court in 1917.
So, Weinberg, I'd like to ask you a question about the old common law view of unauthorized. And that is, we know that fraud can be fraud in the issuance or fraud in the factum. Forgery would be the latter. And so if you say that all, under the common law, all unauthorized transactions are void instead of just merely voidable, what does that do to the middle category, the one that's only fraudulent in the issuance?
I'm not sure I'm following exactly, but if it's fraud, if the document, or in this case the release, was fraudulently issued, it would certainly fall within the meaning of the statute under a fraudulent request.
Well, if the statute is only going so far as to cover what's traditionally fraud in the factum, which forgery would be a fraud in the factum, then how is it that unauthorized, is there ever any document that's only voidable as opposed to void if unauthorized is all void?
I'm certain that there would be documents that could be voidable as opposed to void. What I'm suggesting, I can't think of one off the top of my head.
Right, because when you say unauthorized, that seems to cover all categories of fraud under your view. And so,
there could be fraud in other ways, but whether it's as a product of being unauthorized or because somebody forged the document, you get to the same place, which is that there was no authority for somebody's signature to appear on a document. The difference between the forged scenario and an unauthorized scenario would simply turn on the subjective state of mind of the person signing the instrument, and that can't be the law. Our real estate titles are really in jeopardy. You know, the reason we have a statute of frauds for real estate transactions is to cover this exact circumstance. If there had been a written power of attorney, if there had been written authorization, the public trustee would have been within the public trustee's statutory authority to execute the release. But you didn't have that here. And if you look at that Newman case, which is not an unauthorized case, it is not a unauthorized release of deed of trust case, it's an unauthorized deed. The father in that case signed a deed on behalf of his daughter, as an attorney in fact. It turned out there was no written power of attorney from father to daughter. And that invalidated, not just made it voidable, the Court of Appeals said that deed was void.
Well, they said void, but...
And there was a bona fide purchaser in that case.
And so you're saying in that case that the transaction was actually ineffective against the bona fide purchaser? Because some of these cases confuse void and voidable. I mean, the terminology at one point was fairly interchangeable before the court started paying more attention.
And I haven't done the history on void versus voidable throughout since 1900 to the present. I only can say what they said in the case and what they held in the case, which was that it was void. And the effect of that, it did involve a bona fide purchaser in that case.
Pardon me for interrupting, counsel, but I'm sort of concerned about what the meaning of the word unauthorized is. And so I'd like to ask you two questions. Let me get them both out, and then I'll gladly listen to your answers. The first question is, understanding that we have the word fraudulent in our statute now, and that's what we're focusing on, I would like you to explain to me a situation where you would think unauthorized would be likely to occur in this sort of a situation in which it would not be fraudulent. Okay? And then the second question has to do with the legislative history that you want us to take a look at. And that is, in that legislative history, did the legislators discuss a difference between fraudulent and unauthorized?
Thank you, Your Honor. Let me start with the second question because I think it's probably a little bit easier to answer. You know, in listening to the discussion, I don't see that the legislators considered the distinction between unauthorized and fraudulent. Their sole concern was to reverse a decision from the Court of Appeals that they didn't like. And it was happening at the same time the Supreme Court reversed that, and they simply codified what the Supreme Court did. Oddly enough, they chose words fraudulent request that later appear in the, or that had appeared in the Supreme Court opinion, but I think the bill was probably written before the Supreme Court decision, so I don't know how that all intermeshed, but I did not hear any discussion about that distinction. With respect to the first question, whether, and let me make sure I'm understanding the question, any circumstance where unauthorized would not be fraudulent, and my answer to that question would be no, because an unauthorized signature by definition is one that means that the person that signed the document isn't acting on behalf of the person they're supposed to be acting on behalf of, and that kicks you back into the Upson case, which says there are two requirements to get a release for a deed of trust, and one of those is that the request has to be made by the beneficiary of the deed of trust. If a request is unauthorized, that request is not made by or on behalf of a beneficiary. And that's how I get to answering your question.
If I understand that correctly, doesn't that mean then that as there's very little force behind, your argument, I think, is still, okay, this was fraudulent down below. It fit within the statute. It ought to be set aside. I get that. But by saying what you've just said, doesn't your argument about, well, they ignored the common law really lose force? Because if unauthorized equals fraudulent, then they've incorporated the common law, haven't they?
Well, exactly. I mean, that's why I was a little troubled with the way the court framed the question that it wanted us to address, which is, I argued it the reverse, that under the common law, an unauthorized signature or an unauthorized request is void. The court wanted me to focus on the language fraudulent request. I think you get there either way. Either an unauthorized request is still void under the common law, or it's encompassed within the definition of the statute. And I think you could go either way, but nothing in the statute overturned the common law. Nothing in the statute overturned the holding in Upson. In fact, it was intended to codify the holding in Upson, which again kicks us into those two elements. But I think you can look at the question both ways.
Let me ask you one last question, sure, and then I'll get out of your hair. Let's assume for purposes of argument that we agree with you and that this decision has to be reversed. I want to understand what remedy you're requesting. Is it your position that what would happen here is, if you win, is that there would be a declaration that the transfer on 42 that resulted in about $375,000 would be void?
No. No, I don't have, I mean, they can transfer the property. The deed of trust doesn't impinge upon their ability to transfer the property. The remedy that I'm seeking, the declaration that I'm seeking, is that the deed of trust that was released, that was clearly wrongfully released in violation of statute and common law, would be reinstated as if it had never been released, such that the purchaser, whether bona fide or otherwise, takes the property subject to that deed of trust, which is title insurance.
So perhaps I put it inartfully. Your position would be that your client's interest in Unit 42 would be reinstated. Is that right?
Yeah, my client's deed of trust would be reinstated with the same priority that it had.
Okay. And also, though, I'm assuming that means that if that happens, your clients no longer would have an interest in 50, right?
My clients never accepted a deed of trust in 50, so I don't know what happens to that. If they want to release that, that's fine.
Okay.
We don't have any issue with Unit 50. I only have 2 minutes left, so I'd like to reserve the rest for rebuttal. Thank you.
Counsel, thank you.
Good afternoon, Alan Sweepon, representing Dennis Shaw and First Horizon. We decided, Mr. Floyd Smith and I, to divide our time. I will be taking approximately 11 minutes, of course, depending upon any questions you might have, and Mr. Smith will be taking the last 4 minutes. Was discussed just a few minutes ago, the court posed a question to counsel. In talking with colleagues over the past couple of days, I was encouraged to address that question immediately rather than in the context of an argument. So let me do that. Let me start off right there, even though it's sort of out of order and out of context a bit. The question you asked is, what does fraud mean? And I think fraud has a particular meaning in the context of our law. There's the seminal case, or certainly one of the most important cases that define the elements of fraud, Morrison versus Goodspeed, which is cited in my brief. There are also the elements of fraud that are put down quite clearly in the Colorado jury instructions, 19:1. And the elements of fraud, I think, are fairly well established today. And of course, this statute specifically uses the word fraud. It doesn't use the word...
It says fraudulent.
It says fraudulent. Yeah, it's basically a fraudulent request. But I think the root of the word fraudulent is fraud, and I think, therefore, we have to be talking about fraud. It's an intentional act. It's something more than negligence. I think the legislature certainly could have used a lot of different words. The case that Mr. Weinberg suggests that this statute was enacted directly to deal with the Upson case was a forgery case. It could have used forgery. It could have used a lot of different words, but in fact, the legislature used the word fraudulent. You are correct. And I think that implies that there has to be a fraudulent act. There has to be fraud.
What about constructive fraud? Is the use of the term fraudulent broad enough, perhaps, to include a concept of constructive fraud?
I'm not sure I know what constructive fraud is, to be very candid with you. I mean, I understand the elements of fraud to be a false representation of a past or present fact. The fact has to be material. At the time of the, we're talking about Mr. Floyd Smith's actions here. So at the time of the representation, Mr. Smith had to have known of the falsity. There has to be actual knowledge, or he was aware that he did not know. There has to be intent to rely. And when we talk about reliance, we're talking now about the public trustee's reliance. And so then there, of course, has to be reliance by the public trustee. There has to be the element of justification added in there. And then the last element, which is also one of the important elements, one of the necessary elements that the plaintiff has to prove here, and that's the element of damages. All of those elements have to be proven by the plaintiff by a preponderance of the evidence. That's what the trial court judge, Judge Wilson, held. He actually set forth those exact elements in his findings of fact and conclusions of law. So it would be my position, and I apologize for not answering your question directly because I don't know what constructive fraud is, but I think if the elements are different than what I just set forth, I don't think that's sufficient. I think there has to be a fraudulent act. It has to be something more than negligence. And I think when we talk about unauthorized, quite candidly, that's not a term, at least, that I can find defined. It's certainly not defined in the statute. It's not defined in any case.
Well, it's not in the statute now, is it,
counsel? Yeah, it's not in the statute. It's not in any cases that I could find. So when we talk about an unauthorized act, I think we unnecessarily confuse ourselves because I don't think that that's right. You asked the question whether or not there can ever be an unauthorized act that was not fraud. I think that was your question. You know, I think the act here that we're talking about, this court specifically held, and I'm talking about the actions of Mr. Smith, those were actions that the court determined were negligent. He negligently signed the release, the request for release of the deed of trust.
I understand, Mr. Sweetbaumer, that there was a finding in the trial court that Mr. Smith did not intentionally commit fraud. But the statute doesn't say that there must be a finding that someone committed fraud. It just, or had any particular intent. So what I've come across in doing some research on this is that there are many definitions of fraud and fraudulent that don't encompass intent, especially in the equitable situation and in situations where someone's lost their ability to collect a debt. And so those, in certain circumstances, fraud is presumed in instances where someone has been prevented from collecting a debt. So what we're hoping that you can enlighten us on is why shouldn't we adopt one of those readings of the word fraudulent?
Well, I guess I'm not aware of those definitions. And you said there was fraud presumed. What I don't know and what I can't answer directly, I apologize, Judge Terry, is whether or not intent is still an element. Can you presume intent?
Well, not in these definitions. This is just a smattering from Black's Law Dictionary, for example, fraud in law. Fraud is presumed where someone is prevented from being able to collect their debt, which is somewhat similar to the situation here, because their priority was lost, their position was lost. And you also have a definition of constructive fraud that basically law or equity, public policy forbids something being done to another person's prejudice and doesn't even look at whether there's intent on the actor's part.
Well, you use the word presumption, and I apologize. I haven't looked at those cases, so I can't respond to them directly, but I'm going to make certain assumptions, if that's fair to do here from the podium. And when you talk about presumptions, when you talk about presuming, that's an evidentiary rule. A presumption simply shifts a burden of proof from the burden of the plaintiff to prove all the elements of fraud to the defendant to disprove those elements. So we're simply talking about an evidentiary rule which shifts a burden of proof when you talk about presumptions. At least my understanding, and again, I may be assuming too much, and I apologize if I am, but when you use the word presumptions to me, that's not saying that the elements of fraud still don't have to be there. It's just
Let me ask you about an evidentiary presumption then.
Okay.
In this case, basically, as I read the court's findings, the main point where the court found that there was no fraud was that the burden of proof hadn't been carried on the knowledge of the falsity of the misstatement. This is for the attorney, for the lender aspect of it. Okay. And so if there's a presumption in the law that an attorney is familiar with the law, then how is that rebutted in this case?
Well, it's interesting. The court in its findings of fact relied on that provision, a statute which you're referring to right now, which talked about the attorney for the lender has to be retained
exactly.
by the lender. And then what Judge Wilson held was that there's no evidence that Mr. Smith knew of that statute. I would also ask you to go back and look at that statute, because what that statute specifically talks about is retained by the lender to commence foreclosure. I personally don't think that that particular statute applies. But I think the rest of the court's order is correct. I think the court still focused on the issues that needed to be focused on. The court held that this statute was the sole and exclusive remedy to void a release of deed of trust. I think that's the correct ruling. The court held that it had to be an intentional act. It was set forth the elements of fraud. I think that was correct. And I think then the court held that the actions of Mr. Smith, based upon the testimony that over this two days of trial, the plaintiff didn't meet his burden of proof. So I understand what you're saying, and it is that part of the ruling was somewhat difficult for me, because it was not something that was argued, I think, by either counsel at trial. It was something that the court came up with on his own. The trial judge came up with on his own. But I think the court actually relied on a statute that wasn't a correct statute. Does that answer your question? I think so. So I'm not sure if I answered your question about presumptions. I'm not sure if I've addressed sufficiently the issue of fraud. I do want to address a couple of things. I see I only have a couple minutes left. But you would ask the question, Judge Bernard, about the remedy. Because I think that's another aspect, an important aspect of this, because, of course, what the plaintiff had originally in Unit 42 that was released, the plaintiff claims improperly, was a second deed of trust. If the plaintiff were to be allowed to have his deed of trust just simply reinstated now as a first deed of trust, that would give the plaintiff a windfall. That's something the plaintiff never had. I think the only fair way to deal with all this, if you're even thinking, or if you remand and have the trial judge look at this again, is you have to rescind the entire transaction. And the proper parties aren't even before the court to do that. So I think the remedy aspect of this is important as well.
I agree with you. That's why I asked the question. But assuming that we were to decide that it should go back, of course, please, no problem. Assuming that we decide that it ought to go back, well, it isn't the proper remedy to reinstate Mr. Robbins, actually 17 West Mill, sorry, to where it was before, and that would be, all right, Your second deed of trust, that's where you were before, that's where you are now. Wouldn't that be the proper remedy?
I think that's the only way to do this, and I don't think the proper parties were before the court. I think it would be a very difficult it would be very difficult to get from point A to point B, because somehow Mr. Shaw would have to get his $40,000 back. He paid $40,000 down. First Horizon would have to get back its money. And I don't know how all that gets accomplished. I don't think it can be accomplished. I think, you know, the horse is out of the barn, the water's over the dam, whatever metaphor you want to use, I don't think it's going to be done. It's one of the reasons why...
But isn't that true in any case where the statute is applied?
What is void? My point is, Your Honor, that is a very limited carve-out. That's why I think we can only look at fraud. That's why we can't look at negligence, and we can't look at any unauthorized transfer, because it would throw the state of real estate titles up in the air. We cited some examples in our brief about certain things that title companies or anyone who closes transaction like this would have to look at. Well, you have to look behind what information you would normally look at to determine, and you would potentially go back years, because it is void and not voidable. I agree with you. I mean, by the way, the other transactions that happened in connection with Unit 42 would potentially be void.
And I understand that, Mr. Sweetbaum, but I think the issue for me is, if, let's use another hypothetical, which is not this case, okay?
We're going to add some more time for both parties, just so you don't nervous.
Yeah, we want to make sure Mr. Smith has an opportunity to. Let's assume, for purposes of argument, that we're here after there is a finding of intentional fraud. I know it's not that case, it's hypothetical. And for some reason, the right remedy wasn't executed. And we're talking about the right remedy. Intentional fraud fits under the statute, no excuses. Isn't the right remedy then to, because it's void, to do exactly what I suggested? He goes back in there at his prior position. It's as if it never went down at all. And then folks just have to deal. Am I wrong about that?
Well, I think as a practical matter, you're right about that. I think that's where you are. I'm just trying to point out some of the practical
problems
with this. But yeah, no, I think that's where you are. And I think that's why a statute like this, a provision in the statute like this, has to be so narrowly construed. Because if you opened it up to any unauthorized transfer, if you opened it up to any negligent transfer, which is what Mr. Weinberg alleges the law is, he alleges that this statute did not abrogate the common law in any authorized transfer. By the way, I think that's wrong. And I don't know if I have a minute or two to address that. If I don't, I think we had, well, actually,
I want to just focus you, we'll add more time, but I just wanted to focus you on this. If, let's say, for example, the statute is clearly satisfied, okay?
I'm not talking about this case. Yes.
Even though there's going to be numerous practical difficulties and parties may have to be brought in court and whatever, I mean, that's just what happens.
It's just what happens, exactly right. But it's a balancing of the rights of the parties. Does a subsequent bona fide purchaser have a right to rely on the record? Yes, under most circumstances. No, if it is really actual fraud. That's one of the exceptions that I think this statute carved out. And in that situation, I think, to use your phrase, it is what it is. That's exactly right. You have to go and you got to deal with all sorts of problems, and someone's going to lose out. There's going to be some innocent party who may, not necessarily who may lose. I agree with you, but that's the reason why this has to be such a narrow carve-out, and why when you talk about any unauthorized transfer, that's just too much. It puts the entire state of real estate titles in flux, up in the air. Real quick, I wanted, if I have 30 seconds to address this.
Okay, we'll add four minutes to each side.
Okay, then I'll just address this real fast, because I wanted to talk about what was the law before this statute was enacted, which was sometime around this Upson case came down, I guess just before or just after the Supreme Court Upson case. Mr. Weinberg, the plaintiff in this case, has argued in his briefs, argued in the trial court, that the state of the law, he talks about in his briefs, or the plaintiff talks about in his briefs, the entire body of law would be overturned. In fact, we're talking about two cases that were cited by the plaintiff in this case, one from 1897, one from 1900, and I believe those cases are distinguishable. Those cases dealt with private trustees, not public trustees. Those cases were enacted, I believe, before the public trustee statutes were even, those cases came down before the public trustee statutes were even enacted. And I don't think they really had any bearing. I don't believe the state of the law was that any unauthorized transfer was void or even voidable. And that's, I think with that, I'll give the last 4 minutes to Mr. Smith.
Mr. Sweetham.
Thank you. I'm Floyd Smith. I'm appearing, obviously, on behalf of myself. I'm going to focus on an issue that you've sort of touched on, but neither one of the attorneys have addressed, and that's the issue of damages. Traditionally, one of the elements of fraud is that the plaintiff must show damages. The order of the trial court is fairly clear that the court did not believe that the plaintiff was able to show that he was damaged by the unauthorized release. The court went so far as to say that he offered no evidence of the value of the lien. As Justice Bernard suggested, if you go back and put that lien back in its priority position, what the plaintiff had was a second lien on unit 42 that was behind a first deed of trust that was more than the value of the unit. So the equity value of that lien did not exist. And in fact, at one point, the court characterizes the plaintiff's deed of trust as worthless. So if you put that in the context of fraud and one of the elements of fraud, besides not proving the knowing aspect of it, it appears that the plaintiff did not prove that he was damaged by the fraud. Now, there's no doubt that he had a promissory note that he didn't get paid on, but those damages did not arise from the release. Those damages arose from the fact that the note holder, the borrower, failed to pay the note as required.
Well, Mr. Smith, how about this argument? Please respond to this. I think that your opponent would say, well, there are $375,000 paid over, and of that, $293,000 went to the first, and $81,000 went somewhere else. Why wouldn't I, as the second lien, be in line for that $81,000? And therefore, because we know that $293,000 went to the first and $81,000 went somewhere else, why isn't that my level of damages?
Well, again, because the reason that was able to occur was because that deed of trust was released, and this was all part of a much larger transaction. There were several interrelated closings, and there was no evidence offered that the borrower actually received those proceeds. Typically, when there were several of these closings going on at once, the proceeds from one closing would be used as part of a payoff in another closing. So I don't think there was any proof that the plaintiff ever or the borrower ever received the $81,000, the difference between the sales price and the.
So your position is, even though this $81,000 went somewhere besides the first, it doesn't matter that there was a second in line, that this somehow could have skipped the second and gone somewhere else?
That appears to be the decision of the court, that there just was no clear evidence to measure damages as a result of this release. And actually, in the end, the plaintiff ended up with a deed of trust on another unit that had basically the same value as the original collateral. It was in a second position, although it was in a second position behind a lower first deed of trust.
The court didn't make a finding of fact as the comparable value between Unit 50 and Unit 42, though, right? I know there was evidence about that, but was that in the court's findings?
I don't believe it was. I don't believe the court was specific on that.
Your time has expired, counsel. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for the additional time, Your Honors. Let me tell you why I think this case presents me with a win-win scenario. Either the court adopts my view of the world and says that under the facts here, this deed of trust needs to be reinstated, in which case I win and my client wins. But if the court doesn't do that, if the court affirms, then attorneys such as myself and counsel now have a license to sign requests for release of deeds of trust and property for non-clients. So what I'll do, or what I could do, is my house has a couple $100,000 deed of trust on it. I don't really represent Bank of America, but I had a friend that used to be a teller there, and he said it would be okay if I released it. So if the court affirms the trial court, I think I'm probably okay. I think I have authorization. I might not really, but I think I do. I'm going to go release the deed of trust of my house and own it free and clear. I win either way. That clearly can't be the status of the law. Attorneys have subpoena powers. They have all kinds of powers that you get when you're a lawyer. One of them is not to mess up real estate titles and sign releases for clients that aren't your clients and free up title that way. And I don't think the court could sanction that conduct. As to the remedy, I think you have to your questions on the reinstatement issue, I don't think it's okay to reinstate it into a second position. It is reinstated at the priority point in which it previously existed, which I think was August of 2006. It would be impossible to reinstate it into a second position because we don't know what's happened to the title since then. It was sold to Mr. Shaw. He had two mortgages there as part of that purchase transaction. It's not on the record, but it's since, I believe, been foreclosed on from that point. So we don't really know. And to try to reinstate it into a, quote, second position would be inconsistent with what Upson really says. The remedy in Upson was reinstatement of the lien, and that even a bona fide purchaser takes subject to that because it's between the two innocent parties. We can't let the innocent lien holder suffer. And that is why, and I argue this in the briefs, people in Colorado buy title insurance, and they buy it for a reason. Title insurance companies have to pick up for odd transactions such as this case before you. You know, if this case goes the other way and attorneys are allowed to just willy-nilly release deeds of trust, then title insurance companies are going to be charging a lot more in their premiums because they've got a lot more exposure.
So if you were assessing the monetary amount of damages, would you say it's the $81,000 that's left over or what?
As I argued to the trial court, it depends on which defendant we're talking about. If we're talking about the damages that were caused by, quote, the negligence of Mr. Smith, the answer to your question is yes. His negligence caused us not to receive the $80,000. No other claim, besides the claims on the notes, involved damages. The remedy that is sought is simply put the lien back on where it should have been, in the priority position where it should have been. It is secured by, or the underlying debt for that is in the notes, which have now been reduced to judgment.
Yeah, I guess what bothers me is that from the evidence, it looks like there was a $500,000 first place lien at the time of closing, which was paid off for much less. Mm-hmm. But we don't know if this was a typical like short sale situation where the bank is accepting less, or whether that they got something in this multi-part, you know, $1 million transaction to replace the extra half of the lien that they didn't get the cash for. And so that's what I have a hard time figuring out, how that should come into play or be sorted out.
I think you're right. I don't think there was evidence about what happened with the rest of that transaction. But right, we do know that they accepted the 200 or two, whatever the number was, to go away. And they had liens on multiple units. So it was a partial release for them. And I think what we do know is that the $80,000 damages caused by the negligence, quote unquote, that much is clear on the claim against Mr. Smith. However, the other claims are simply put the lien back. If Mr. Smith were to write a check for $80,000, that would certainly reduce the amount that is overall owed to my client on the notes, for which he could then foreclose or do whatever he needs to do to enforce the liens. I don't know if I've answered your question. Okay. In the last time that I have, I just want to note again the facts, the underlying facts on why the request was fraudulent within the meaning of the statute, or certainly within the common law unauthorized provision, and there's 5 points. He signed this document as attorney for the lender. trial court found he wasn't the attorney for the lender. He was the attorney for the borrower. And therefore, again, under Upson, there was no request made by the beneficiary of the deed of trust. He represented the promissory note had been paid when it hadn't. He represented that the purpose of the deed of trust had been satisfied when it hadn't. There was no replacement collateral that was given. He never had possession of the modified note that went from 75 to 134. He never had the original note, so he couldn't have tendered that. He knew there was a second note. If you look at the May 31st, 2007 letter that he wrote, it's referenced in there. And he signed this. This is important. He signed this as the attorney for the lender, rather than having Mr. Demko sign it, in order to circumvent the process that the public trustee had set up, the requirement for a written power of attorney when the request is made by an agent, as opposed to no power of attorney required when the request is made by an attorney.
Feinberg, your time has expired. Thank you to all counsel for your arguments. They have been helpful to the court. And I would state this is an unusual circumstance. We don't have another argument after yours. And the judges, as you could see, had many questions about your argument. However, if you're before the Court of Appeals again and need to split time, you can't expect that the same will happen, that we'll add time to the clock. But we do appreciate your arguments. That concludes our document for today. The court will stand in recess. A written opinion will issue in due course. And the-